Well, it's probably quite appropriate discussing this subject of fascism, given the fact it's the 75th anniversary of the events in Cable Street, took place on the 4th of October 1936, when Oswald Mosley, who was the leader of the British Union of Fascists, I knew I should turn the phone off, that's a good start, the leader of the British Union of Fascists, decided to walk, or march rather, through East London as a provocation to not only the working class of this area, in East London, but also the Jewish population. The heroic struggle that took place on that day was to prevent Mosley entering East London, and despite some calls on the Home Office to ban the march, the government wanted to allow the march to go ahead because they were quite favourably disposed to Mosley and fascism, believe it or not. But it was a turn of the mass mobilisation of socialist organisations, the Communist Party, Young Communist League, the Trotskyists, the Labour Party, the Independent Labour Party, the trade unions, Jewish organisations, whole number of the gamut of organisations turned out to prevent the fascists marching, and they succeeded in doing so. Mosley was forced to abandon the march and dissipate his forces. And that was a great setback for him and a great victory, really, for the Labour movement and the anti-fascists at that particular time. Of course, anniversaries are something to study in order to not just be inspired by these things, but also to learn the lessons of history. After all, if you don't learn the lessons of history, there's a danger of repeating the lessons of history. And above all, we're examining this question of fascism from a Marxist point of view, from the point of view of the class dynamics involved, in order to discover whether it is possible or whether it is likely that a fascist movement could develop in the future, whether it be in Britain or elsewhere. Clearly, from our own point of view, those who think about fascism immediately consider or think about Hitler's Germany, or Mussolini's Italy, or Franco's Spain as examples of fascist regimes whose characteristics were extreme reaction and of the crushing of the labour organisations in those countries, crushing of all democratic rights, subjugation of the state, a regime of terror, if you like, which penetrated deep down into the roots of society. Trade unions were declared illegal and reorganised, vertical reorganisation of the unions, political parties were banned, and the fascists had a monopoly, if you like, of political power. And clearly that was an extremely serious situation, not only for the workers in those countries, but also a serious situation for the world at that time, particularly the working class. And there are, of course, a lot of myths, I would say, that are spread about those days, and particularly the credentials of the British government in relation to fighting fascism. You know, that we went to war, as you know, in 1939 against Germany under the slogan of anti-fascism. And this was the sort of cloak, if you like, which British imperialism in particular used to cover its own war interests. I would say that the war was not carried out for anti-fascist reasons, but to defend the interests, the material interests of British capitalism vis-a-vis against German capitalism and Italian for that matter. And I say this because I've got some interesting quotes here, perhaps you've seen them before, but they're not well advertised. There's one from Winston Churchill, and Winston Churchill is supposed to be a very courageous fighter against fascism, but he was a great admirer of Mussolini. He was a great admirer of Hitler prior to the Second World War. For instance, on the 20th of January 1927, speaking in Rome, Churchill said, "I could not help being charmed, like so many other people have been, by Signor Mussolini's gentle and simple bearing and his calm, detached poise in spite of so many burdens and dangers. If I had been an Italian, I am sure that I should have been wholeheartedly with you from the start to finish in your triumphant struggle against the bestial appetites and passions of Leninism. I will, however, say a word on an international aspect of fascism. Externally, your movement has rendered service to the whole world." So, you know, it's quite clear on this. "Italy has shown that there is a way of fighting the subversive forces which can rally the masses of the people. She has provided the necessary antidote to the Russian poison. Hereafter, no great nation will be provided with an ultimate means of protection against the cancerous growth of Bolshevism." That was Winston Churchill. You might have thought, "Oh, well, that was 1927, but he, you know, changed his views a bit." Well, here's a quote down from Churchill in 1939, just prior to the war. "The story," this was in Great Contemporaries, is this? "The story of that struggle cannot be read without admiration for the courage, the perseverance, the vital force which enabled him to challenge, defy, conciliate or overcome all authorities or resistance which barred his path. I've always said that if Great Britain were defeated in war, I hope we would find a Hitler to lead us back to our righteous position amongst nations." So it gives you a little flavour of where Winston Churchill stood in the 1930s, and he didn't stand alone. A lot of the ruling class in Britain were very sympathetic to fascism. In fact, many of the newspaper owners were very sympathetic, including the Daily Mail, who had a front page banner headline in 1936, "Hurrah for the Black Shirts." So, you know, giving a little bit of a flavour indication, the British government also were in favour of deals with Nazi Germany to provide them with not only raw materials, but encourage them to rearm as well, to become a bulwark, as I can quote it further if you like, a bulwark against Bolshevism. So a strong Germany would be in British interest because it would be a bulwark against Stalin's Russia. And that was the cynical, if you like, views of the ruling class at that time. They were in favour of, they supported fascism where it was necessary, as they saw it, in their own particular class interests. Of course, in Britain, you had the development of the Mosley movement, the British Union of Fascists, and they also were financed by big business, not only in Britain, but also internationally. You got money from Mussolini. Of course, he was a millionaire anyway, and therefore he used a lot of this money together with other interests in order to develop the fascist movement in Britain. And, of course, in the early 1930s, this movement did take on quite a certain size, particularly between 1932 and 1936, particularly after the development of the slump on Wall Street, the Great Crash and the Great Depression, of mass unemployment on an enormous economic crisis on a world scale. And, of course, you could say, hang on a minute, there are certain parallels here insofar as we have now also experienced the worst economic crisis since the 1930s. And this crisis is not simply getting better, but getting worse. That is, mass unemployment has appeared in all the major capitalist countries. It is in a period of capitalist crisis. And many commentators, including economists, say even as dangerous or as deep as the 1930s itself. And therefore, you might say, well, if that is the case, is there not a danger, therefore, of fascism emerging? Because obviously, like conditions can give like results. But I think you have to get a little more deeper than this, you know, not simply look at the surface, but because there are, you do get this occasionally that some people jump up and down and they say, well, the BNP has done well in Dagenham, for instance, or the EDL has marched here or there. My Christ, is a danger of fascism in Britain. But I think that would be, over-egging the pudding somewhat, over-exaggerating the dangers at this particular stage, although I can understand how individuals in those different areas would feel about the antics of these particular racist organisations. But nevertheless, in relation to whether they could become a mass force, I would say is completely ruled out at the present time. And the reason why I say that, do we have to look at history in order to look at the reasons for the development of fascism? And I mean the mass forces of fascism that took place in the 1930s. And that resulted mainly from the, as I explained earlier, fundamentally the crisis of capitalism at that time, the deep crisis that was affecting world capitalism, and the fact that more and more governments could not introduce or maintain reforms that they could previously. And in fact, the whole position of the day was austerity and the need to cut back on the reforms. They couldn't, afford the concessions that they had granted previously to the working class. After all, we should say that we have today democratic rights. Obviously, we can meet here, we can vote in elections, we have free speech and so on. But all those things were won by hard struggles in the past. They weren't given freely by the ruling class. In Britain, it took years of struggle, particularly by the labour movement, the trade union movement, to bring about these rights that we have at the present time. And the capitalists are not necessarily interested, and I say that, big business is not necessarily interested, in providing things which will in any way threaten their particular interests. As perhaps, it is true, I did write this book, and it's about the history of British trade unions. Goes back to it begins in 1799, where the government at that time introduced the Combination Acts, where the early trade union movement was illegalised. They were banned. In fact, they weren't recognised in any legal way until 1825, and then a very semi-legality at that particular time. So even the right to a trade union organisation was illegal. Not so very long ago. And it was the struggle of working people which forced their rights to organise and defend their particular interests. And you find that that's the case that all democratic rights have been won in this particular way. Now, capitalism, there's this history of capitalism, and in its early years, if you read the Communist Manifesto, for instance, which I hope you've all done, you'll note that Karl Marx praises capitalism. He says, first of all, the capitalists in their early period played a very, very progressive role in developing production, developing the means of production, developing society, developing the world market, and so on and so forth. It was a young, dynamic system. Yes, it was very exploitative, there's no doubt about that. It exploited the working class viciously. However, as an economic system, it had, if you like, in its early years, was very dynamic in its expansion and development. And in those years, the working class began to fight for its own particular interests, its own particular rights. And over a period of time, the capitalists were forced to give these particular rights, the right to organise free speech, etc., etc. In fact, I would say, the establishment of democracy, which was won by struggle, also favoured, or was also, in one sense, favoured by the ruling class, because democracy is a very cheap form of government, unlike dictatorship. Democracy itself allows also a safety valve in society, allows people to blow off steam, gives greater stability in society if they can afford it. And the problem with capitalism is, because we're looking at capitalism in its early days and phases, is that it reaches its maturity, but it also enters into decline. And with the decline of capitalism, then the system itself cannot provide the same reforms as it did in its heyday. And therefore the capitalists attempt to weaken the struggle of the working class, attempt to take back the gains that they've made, and for their point of view, even are prepared to turn towards military police dictatorships in order to maintain their particular form of society where the working class has become too strong in their opinion. And you can look, you know, over the last 100 years, and look in different countries where dictatorships have been formed in order to keep the working class in check. However, we have to say that fascism, which emerged in Italy in 1922, the victory of Mussolini, and with Hitler in 1933, was a totally different form of reaction to the old kind of military dictatorships or police dictatorships that had occurred at that time or previous to that. That fascism was a particularly vicious form of reaction, a special form of reaction, which in effect its aim was to destroy all the organizations of the working class, because for the capitalists they now became incompatible with the continuation of capitalism. In other words, if capitalism cannot afford to grant reforms, and you have organizations like trade unions and political parties fighting for those reforms, organizing workers to fight for those reforms, then there comes a time when these organizations, the strength of these organizations, fighting for decent pay, decent reforms and so on, come into conflict with the interests of capitalism itself. And the capitalists of in the 1930s looked towards fascism in order to atomize the working class. But even then, before they could turn towards this kind of reaction, and Trotsky described it as fascism is a special form of reaction. It is the worst form of reaction in one sense. It is like the distilled essence of imperialism. It just destroys everything. It destroys organizations, even down to the workers' chess clubs in Germany. It tries to atomize the working class, in other words, not only render it completely defenseless, atomize it, split it up into its own different component parts, renders it helpless, completely helpless. And that's what the fascism is able to do as a mass movement. Because in the past, military dictatorships were based upon the use of the army or the police force or other forms of state repression. When it comes to fascism, it doesn't rest on the police force or the army. It is the mobilization of masses, of millions of people who are ruined, who generally come from the middle classes who are ruined. If you look at fascism, it tends to come from the peasantry, which have been completely devastated by economic crisis, by the middle classes who are completely and utterly ruined and bankrupt, and the more lumpen proletariat, as Marx explained, the long-term unemployed. And fascism mobilizes, organizes this human mass of desperation, builds it up as it's going to emancipate it, but it doesn't, it does, it betrays it. But nevertheless, it gives it the idea that that it's going to win out of changing society by breaking down all classes and forming the nation, basically based on this concept of nation as opposed to class. And the German Nazi movement, for instance, Hitler's movement, rested upon the desperation of the ruined middle classes in the 1920s. In 1923, for instance, in Germany, you had hyperinflation, the occupation of the Ruhr by the French, the humiliation after the First World War, the Versailles Treaty being imposed, and this hyperinflation just ruined all businesses itself, all small, and drove the middle class into a complete frenzy. The peasantry also were ruined. Agriculture was ruined on the basis of the crisis. And the fascists turned towards these layers, these middle layers, not the working class, but these middle layers were in a desperate plight, organized them in order to smash the labor movement itself. And fascism basically is that. It is the physical organization of layers of the population to crush the other layers of the population, the working class, to atomize it. And therefore you see under fascist dictatorships, it's a reign of terror and spy networks, not just for really in every single office block, in every workplace, everywhere, it penetrates right down. That's why it's a mass movement. It's not simply a military dictatorship involving the military itself. This is a mass movement involving millions of ruined petty bourgeois, peasants in particular, lumpen proletariat, which are used as a battering ram then to smash the labour movement. And it becomes a physical struggle. Hitler's gangs were used to physically just not just beat up, but also intimidate, crush, prevent any meetings taking place, destroy the labour movement as a whole. The same thing took place with Mussolini. However, you could say, because it's worth us analysing a little bit more in depth, fascism could only come about in Germany or in Italy or in Spain, for that matter, after the defeat of the working class itself. That they were, in other words, there had been a series, before fascism had come to power, before that, there had been a whole series of revolutionary uprisings in Germany, for instance, in 1918, in 1919, in 1920, 1923, where the working class could have taken power. So there was, in other words, there was a radicalization of society, there was revolution in society, and the working class were given an opportunity to change society themselves, to come to power. Unfortunately, they were defeated. But the working class was defeated again and again and again and again. Every attempt for them to take power was lost, mainly because of the actions of their own particular leaders. And every defeat just resulted in demoralization, despair, but also sent the middle layers in society just frantic because of the crisis itself. They were looking for a way out. And the fascist movement comes along and says it can solve the problems. Its program is one of semi-socialistic, actually. It's against the banks, against the cartels, of course the Jewish banks in particular, but against the banks of the capitalists, of the big people, of the big men, the big interests who dominate you and all that. And they try to whip up a movement which is then directed against the working class itself. And that's the essence of fascism. It becomes a battering ram to break down every organization of the working class. In terms of Nazi Germany, when Hitler came to power, he destroyed the trade unions. He destroyed every single political party. They were all jailed, and eventually they were taken to the concentration camps. There was an atomization of society. The same in Italy. That, again, prior to the victory of Mussolini, you had revolutionary movements in Italy. In fact, in 1920, in September 1920, you had the occupation of the factories. And the working class, again, could have taken power in Italy in 1920. But again, the leadership failed to see it through. And the movement ebbed. The revolution was defeated. And Mussolini, who in actual fact was a socialist prior to the war, learned a little bit of trying to build a movement amongst the middle layers. Because he knew that the middle layers weren't an independent class. That they had sided with the working class and they sided with the capitalist class. And he was able to use his knowledge of this in order to build a support amongst this petty bourgeois layer, amongst the peasantry in particular. And they were used in order to intimidate and to terrorize the workers' organizations, where headquarters of the Socialist Party, headquarters of the trade unions were attacked, blown up, people were assassinated. So in other words, it becomes a terror gang, if you like, but on a wide scale, not just a small, on a wide scale, in order to crush the labor movement itself. And that's the essence of fascism. It is not like a police dictator. It is to really go down to the, destroy everything, destroy every element of workers' rights in society, completely every element of workers' organization in society is eliminated, is crushed. So it's not the same as the old type of military dictatorship. It is a special form of reaction that goes right down to the very core of society. And that's why it lasts, that's why the reaction lasts so long. Because the working class is completely atomized. It's completely prostrate in society. It just can't do anything. It's completely impotent. And that's why, and this society, this regime of terror can last quite a long period of time because of the atomization of the working class itself. So it's a very, very unique, if you like, and very special form of reaction which is applied by the ruling class at a certain period of time. All I would say is now, of course, yes, we have capitalist crisis. It's true that the capitalists are attempting to introduce austerity. So they cannot afford the reforms they had in the past. Pensions, health service, education, you name it. It's counter-reforms. They're taking back. And in the future, they'll take more back as the crisis deepens as well. Or they'll attempt to take more back. But as you know, there's a fight back taking place. That the working class doesn't just simply accept these attacks. On the contrary, it goes on itself. It goes on the defensive. And as we see that on the 30th of November, there will be a public sector strike in Britain of several million workers, probably bigger than any other struggle or strike wave since the perhaps 1926, the general strike of 1926. So things are coming back with the class struggle is coming back after being quite at a low ebb for a long period of time. And with the class struggle coming back, obviously the ruling class starts to think about its options insofar as the crisis means that they cannot afford to not just grant concessions, they have to take away the concessions they granted in the past. That's, they can't afford it. They have to do it, whether they like it or not. And that's taking place not only in Britain, but throughout the whole of the capitalist world. The only thing is, I would say, that the organisations of the working class have never been stronger, insofar as the working class has never been stronger. And if you compare it to the 1930s and the 1920s, you can see the working class is the overwhelming majority of society in most of the countries of the world, let alone, you know, America, Britain, France, a number of countries, as was the case in the 1930s. It's the overwhelming majority now. In fact, the peasantry as a social layer has shrunken right down. In France, for instance, I think it was nearly 50% of the population prior to the war. In Germany, it was like 40% of the population were peasants prior to the Second World War. Today, you're talking about 1 or 2%. I mean, there's been an enormous contraction. Why? Because of industrialization. Because the development of capitalism internationally has created a strong working class all over the world. And the middle layers are becoming less and less and less, or having themselves become proletarianized. You know, for instance, I would say teachers or civil servants who in the 1930s regarded themselves as a very privileged layer, were very conservative in their outlook. In fact, could be quite reactionary in their outlook. I would also add to that students. In the 1930s, students were quite a reactionary layer of society. In the 1926 general strike, for instance, they formed quite a basis for the strike breakers at that time. And in many of the universities, the British Union of Fascists organised quite a basis in society. Look how far that has changed at the present moment. Today, students are very radicalised, very anti-capitalist, if you like, in their views. They're completely different from what they were in the 1920s and 1930s, which is reflects a decisive change in society itself. Youth, after all, are kind of barometer of the social moods in society. And clearly, I would say that students would and will be there out on the 9th of November. They'll be also supporting the workers on the 30th of November. Rather than strike breaking, they'll be supporting. So therefore, we can see a massive change in the balance of forces, of class balance of forces, if you like, between today and what it was in the 1920s and the 1930s. And therefore, the idea that the capitalists, although they can be in difficulties, and they are in difficulties, they tend now, even more now, to rest upon the trade union leaders, to get the union leaders to try and do their dirty work for them, or political parties. They're not looking for fascists, or what I mean, the fascist movement. They're not trying to build the fascist movement as they did in the 1920s and 30s. And where you have these little groups and incidents, like in Norway, for instance, where we have that maniac, massacred a number of people in the name of basically a kind of fascist type of ideology. It was an individual. It didn't represent anything of any substance in society. Same also in Britain with the EDL. They are a minor irritant, if you like. But certainly not the mass forces of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists prior to the Second World War. They're very, very small. And it reflects really the prominent, the weight of the working class in society, the change balance of forces in society, the fact, as I perhaps mentioned a bit earlier, you know, teachers and civil servants, which regard themselves as a privileged position prior to the war, today are pretty much what you could call proletarianized, insofar as they're all in unions, not only in unions, but they're all in quite militant unions. They're the ones who are balloting for industrial action and so on and so forth. And they have left-wing union leaderships, whether it be the NUT or in particular the PCS, the Civil Service Union. They are left-wing unions. So there's a dramatic difference between today and the 1920s and the 1930s. And that the idea that the ruling class can, even if it wanted to move towards fascism is not on the cards at all. Because they could not develop a fascist movement. The social forces do not exist at the present time. Does that mean that, you know, reactions therefore off the cards? We can all, you know, sleep peacefully on our beds in the night and not worry about the future and so on? I don't think I wouldn't go that far. Because what I'd say is that this crisis that we are facing is provoking upheavals internationally. You can see on your television sets the struggles in Greece in particular, the fighting is taking place. You can see that the anti-capitalist feelings all over the world. In fact, you had riots in Britain, which is symptomatic of the impasse of society, really. There's no future for young people and so on and so forth. Which gives rise to all these kind of things. There's a radicalization taking place internationally, I would say. But also, I'd say that the capitalists are not stupid. They are also thinking, bloody hell, what are we going to do about this? Because we've got a crisis, we have to cut back. At the same time, the workers are resisting. Young people are resisting. What are we going to do? And they will be attempting, obviously, to try and enforce the austerity onto people. But they wouldn't necessarily succeed everywhere. They can be pushed back. And therefore, there'll come a time when they will feel that democracy doesn't really work. And the reason why I say that is not a new idea, not even in Britain. In the 1970s, you had a whole host of conspiracies taking place in Europe and in Britain, where discussions were taking place in the clubs and the smoke-filled clubs at that time of big business about what the problems were, about the militancy of the working class, of how to solve this problem, and there were discussions even in the Times in 1974. Articles appeared about the lessons of Germany 1920, Could there be a putsch in Britain? And if so, would it succeed? Which is probably the $64,000 question, because they were really considering this. They even there was a guy called Brigadier Kitson in 1973-74 brought a book out called Low Intensity Operations, which it got quite a lot of publicity. He said, well, the British Army, the future role of the British Army is not so much its activities outside of Britain, but what's it going to do inside of Britain in maintaining social order? And there were discussions at that time of whether or not, things were getting out of hand. Strikes were very high level. The labour movement was very strong. And there were questions raised about what should be done about it. The only thing is that the balance of forces at that time, again, was much, much against any attempts towards a coup or any attempts towards military dictatorship to solve problems. I mean, it does happen in Greece, for instance, in 1967, I remember, believe it or not, and there was a coup. And the generals came to power, and basically there was an extremely authoritarian regime in Greece from 1967 to 1973. In 1973, the military regime collapsed, and it gave rise to a revolutionary development in Greece. Revolution was on the order of the day. In other words, even if they tried to introduce a repressive regime in society, all it does is stoke up radical feelings against the capitalism, and it doesn't solve the problem. On the contrary, it gives rise, it radicalizes, it makes things worse for them. So therefore, they have to be very careful. I mean, sometimes they will go for it. Like in 1973, they waged the coup in Chile, and it was a successful coup after the disillusionment with the Allende government, and 30,000 workers were murdered. So it wasn't like, these things in Latin America, in Argentina, there were coups. And in fact, the whole of Latin America after that was caught up in a whole series of coups. And they were extremely repressive altogether. Fortunately, that's all changed now. It's amazing. You look at Latin America now, there's not one military regime in Latin America. In fact, there are left governments that have come to power. Again, that shows the changed class balance of forces. But the balance of forces are a balance. They can change. And the way they can change, really, is if workers become disillusioned and demoralized and apathetic. And that can happen if they get the opportunity to change society comes in their way and they defeat it. And it comes in their way again and they defeat it again. And they defeat it again and defeat it again. A whole series of defeats for the working class can lead then to demoralization. And it's at that time that the ruling class attempts to use the situation for their own advantage. But I would say that's going to take quite a while, to be honest about it, given the balance of the forces that exist today. This is just the beginning of the radicalization that's taking place, I would say, of the British working class. And it's the beginning everywhere. So it's not at the end of the process, it's the beginning of the process. However, if we are looking at things from a Marxist point of view, we must always look at the long term as well and look at where things can lead. And it would be silly of us, it would be foolish of us to think that the ruling class would not move towards reaction at a certain point in the future when it felt it was necessary. And although we've had many, many years, many decades, many generations in Britain above all of parliamentary democracy, and we all take it for granted. I mean, everybody here, I'm sure, takes it for granted. But we have to look at history as well. Lots of other people took things for granted. Workers in Chile took things for granted prior to the coup. And you have to understand what the reality is, the concrete circumstances, and to understand from history. At the moment, there's no danger whatsoever of reaction in Britain or elsewhere for that matter, given the strength of the labour movement, the strength of the working class, and the weakness of the ruling class, as a matter of fact. That's the point. However, that doesn't mean to say it's going to be there forever. On the contrary, given the economic crisis on a world scale, These are big challenges now that will come before the working class. And if the working class does not rise to the challenge and change society and overthrow capitalism, then eventually the capitalists will say, we cannot tolerate this situation anymore. You know, we cannot afford this situation anymore. We cannot tolerate this democracy, these trade unions, this... And they can, like there's even talk today, although it's premature, in Greece, whether there's going to be a coup in Greece, they talked about, because of the turmoil and so on. I don't believe that's going to be the case, because the workers are too strong. But if the workers are defeated, and defeated repeatedly, then the balance of forces can change, and therefore you have the possibility then of the ruling class taking advantage of the situation. But I would say even then, they're in big difficulties, because they haven't got the reserves that they had in the past. What are they going to do? Rely on the students? The students are on the bloody streets, supporting the workers. The middle classes, well, they are ruined, but the middle classes also are tending to look to the left. So rather than looking to the right, society is looking to the left at the present time. It's anti-capitalist at the present time, anti-bankers at the present time. All these moods, if you like, are looking in that direction. And I think that is the case internationally. However, we mustn't be lulled into the idea that that's it then, we're okay, we're safe, we're home and dry. We're not home and dry yet until we change society, because at the end of the day, it's capitalism that can produce reaction. And whereas it might not be fascist reaction, which I think is ruled out because the balance of forces is completely changed, even the question of military dictatorships are very, very risky from the point of view of big business everywhere. And they would have to think, not once, not twice, 1,000 times before embarking on such a move. But if they came to it and they were desperate enough, they would take that road if they had to. And we must be aware of this, and aware that even in Britain, good old democratic Britain, you can have this change in the situation and the emergence of reaction if the working class does not take power itself into its own hands and change society and eliminate the crisis of capitalism in the interests of everybody. But if they don't do that, and that's the warning, and that requires leadership, because at the end of the day, revolutions will come whether we are here or not, by the way, they're going to be on the cards. They're going to be there, because objectively, conditions produce revolutions. The main thing is, are they going to be successful revolutions? Because that's the key. Are they going to be all defeated? Because if they are defeated, then all they can do is add to further defeats, unless the labour movement can have a leadership that's prepared to go all the way. And we think that it requires a Marxist leadership to learn from the past and prepare for the future. But anyway, I think it's 75 years now since Cable Street. It's a long time ago. But we should remember those days. We should remember the lessons. Yes, we must look at the differences. That's quite clear. But we also have to say we have to energetically work to change society, because if we do not do that, sooner or later, the capitalists will be forced to try and take back not just our economic gains, but also our political gains. They will put an end to democracy, if it meant saving their profits, saving their privileges, and saving their power. So therefore, this is not a little game. You know, as Spinoza once said, ours is not to weep or to cry, but to learn. And I think it's exactly what we have to do, to learn from history, educate ourselves, prepare for the future, change society. Thank you.